You're tuned to Tidings, and this is Hazel Kahn. This is our 20th Tidings program, and today we're talking about what home means to people who were raised as third culture kids and who grew up to be global nomads. Full disclosure, this is a personal story in which you'll hear my conversation with my school friends from a very faraway place and a very long ago time. Midge, Pat, and I were children together in a boarding school called Woodstock, set in the Himalayas of India, while our parents lived in India, Pakistan, or other countries. We didn't know we were third culture kids until a few years ago, in a presentation at a school reunion. There we were introduced to the work of two sociologists, David Pollack and Ruth Van Recken, who had written a book titled Third Culture Kids. The audience erupted into a series of ahas, giggles, and whispers. "So that's who we are," a woman said, smiling, nodding her head, while her spouse grumbled, "So that's why you're like that." For us in the audience, everything fell into place. Now we had a name. Now we could recognize ourselves and each other. Also referred to as global nomads, third culture kids are people who spent a significant part of their developmental years outside their primary culture, the culture from which their parents came, also referred to as their home or passport culture. In the case of my school friends, this was the United States. My home culture was less clear, since my parents were refugees and had neither passports nor a home culture to which they could return. The second culture was where we actually grew up, in this case, India. The third culture was an interstitial culture, the culture that grew up between the first and second cultures and the one that we inhabited. Although my friends were Mish kids, that is, the children of missionaries, other parents worked in the diplomatic or military services or in the business sector. The third culture is highly mobile. Its people are always coming and going, their lives marked by arrivals and departures, creating a child and teenager who became skilled at developing relationships. If you're a third culture kid, you might jump into a new relationship quickly and deeply, with an urgency born of knowing the next move is always on the horizon. Or you might remain at a superficial level, shying away from closeness, because you're already anticipating the loss of that intimacy as departure time looms. If you're a third culture kid, you might feel wrong or out of place a lot of the time, not knowing the ropes, because you're always having to learn a new culture, including your home culture. Coming back to America from India, my friends remember how they did not understand its popular culture, its slang and social rules, how things work, what was expected of them. Because they looked like everyone else in their hometown, they were expected to behave the same too, even though they may have thought and felt quite differently. They felt other, but didn't look it. At the same time, in India, they looked other, but may not have felt it, leaving them confused when their second culture responded to them as if they were foreigners or strangers. Feeling different wherever they are, third culture kids tell their childhood stories, not realizing they may come off as arrogant or boastful to those who don't come from a third culture. Given this strong but sometimes murky identity, one can understand why my classmates and I have a strong attachment to our past and to each other, with connections that last for decades and assert themselves with special strength at school reunions. You can hear us confess that other third culture kids are the only ones who get it, and are therefore the only ones among whom we can feel truly at home. It takes one to know one. It's a precious and enduring recognition. The mobile third culture kid grows into a restless global nomad adult, unable to escape the need to be on the move, to always have another place in mind, which can be very disconcerting to other members of our families. I call this place elsewhere. mobility, restlessness, a certain detachment. And it's no surprise that some third culture kids harbor an eccentric view of home and an odd way of describing what home means to them. In Paper Airplanes in the Himalayas, The Unfinished Path Home, Paul Seaman describes what home meant to him growing up in India. Here's Jack Gregory reading from this book.
Like nomads, we moved with the seasons. Four times a year, we packed up and moved to, or back to, another temporary home. We learned early that home was an ambiguous concept, and wherever we lived, some essential part of our lives was always someplace else. So we were always of two minds. We learned to be happy and sad at the same time. Home might refer to the school dormitory or to the house where we stayed during the summer, to our family's home where our parents worked, or more broadly, to the country of our citizenship. And while we might have some sense of belonging to all of these places, we felt fully at home in none of them.
Restless wind, how restless wind that yearns to wander, and he was born the next of kin, the next of kin.
Pat is a second-generation third culture kid and second-generation Mish kid who lives in Upper Michigan, except when she lives elsewhere. What is home? I asked her.
Home is where I am at the time. It's a place that I love. It's where my family is, my closest family is. I think my perception of home was very much impacted by mother's ability to make any place we were home. At one point, after we were back in this country, mother and dad were between assignments, and for a short period of time, we stayed in a house that was totally vacant. It was to be demolished the week after we left, and we slept on army cots. But mother had flowers in a vase on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And so the physical space, I think, is not as important as what goes on there. I think maybe for me, home is in some sense more fluid than perhaps for others who really tie it to a place. I feel at home, but as I said, I feel at home here. Then when I get to India, I feel at home there. There's no question that my home here on Crystal Lake holds a very special place in my mind and heart, but the lodge in Manas last January also was, I just felt very comfortable and at home there.
You hadn't been there before, right? Or had
never
you?
Never been there.
So
never
it's not. So it's not to do with familiarity, this feeling
no.
of being at home.
Although I think part of the reason that lodge in Manas felt so comfortable was because it was somewhat similar to the bungalow that I grew up in.
In India?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Where is home? I asked my school chum Midge, who lives in New York, except when she doesn't.
I used to marvel at the deep emotion that my mother and father would exhibit when they would talk about home. It was a very mystical thing. I associated my mind with the heaven and strawberries. Those were the three things that they used to use the same tone of voice to talk about, all of which were totally unreachable as far as I could figure out.
And the tone of voice was what?
It was a very loving, nostalgic kind of an emotional thing. So I I came to have this odd association in my mind with all of these things, but it seemed terribly important to me. And then later on, I began to wonder what constituted home for me. And I concluded that it was the place where I usually wasn't, because we, as Mish kids, we were sent away to boarding school.
Yes, of course, we're talking about India now.
Yes,
you,
right.
You haven't said where you
oh,
actually
I'm sorry.
Were. Yeah.
Yes. We were sent away to boarding school, and so home apparently was where we were from, but not where we were currently. And it was an odd thing to think about when we were at home, so to speak. My parents, at least, were what they called district missionaries, which meant they worked out in the villages. So we spent much of our vacation from school, we spent camping in the villages. So we were never home. We were always away from home. But home was this mythical kind of place where you wanted to be, but you weren't. I'm not sure, even when I'm at my address, that I really feel at home. And I don't know quite how to understand
well,
that.
Well, maybe, you know, maybe feeling at home means that you are 100% in that place, and there's a comfort level, or there's a fit, there's a fit. Whereas when I think of elsewhere, which is, I consider elsewhere my second home, this is the home I'm in now, but there's always elsewhere, because that I have to have elsewhere in my mind. It's the mythical elsewhere in my mind, so that I can then feel okay. Otherwise, I would feel very claustrophobic, or very, not just claustrophobic, but I'm not sure whether it's too anchored. No, there's just the fit. There's always, that's what it is. There's always a gap between me and wherever I am, wherever I am. So even in my own home, there's a gap because there's always somewhere else that I could also be and will go, not necessarily prefer to be at this particular time, but will go to at some stage and need to go to be complete. I have to have more than the place I'm in. So maybe feeling at home means when there is no such gap, when you are complete where you are, there's no yearning for another place, there's no gap between your, I don't know, your shell where you are and, you know, the shell fits perfectly. I don't know, something like that maybe. So when you say, you know, you were saying, of course, literally you're not at home, but even when you are at what is your home, you're not completely at home.
Yeah. I think I'm always just waiting for the next chance to be away, which would be comparable to your elsewhere.
And also a direct outgrowth. Consequence of being a third culture kid, because that's what third culture kids did. They were always about to go somewhere else.
Yes, the very temporary feeling about place.
But yet, we, having all been at the same school and the same place in India and so on, that means then. But there is still a very strong pull for a lot of people to a school that they left decades ago. Do you think it's become a kind of a, not a nirvana maybe, but a mythical,
I think,
you know,
so. It's the place,
city on a hill sort of thing?
Yeah. I think it's the place where people feel that everybody else understands them because everybody else is in the same peculiar situation. And most of us do not feel well understood by the communities we move in now. So I think we look back and we, in a sense, we make that school experience a kind of a home for ourselves, because that's where the people are that know and love me, and they're a given group. You didn't choose your classmates. They were handed to you. so to speak. And that's the way with family. You don't really choose your family.
So it's more organic. It grows out of the soil or whatever.
Yeah. So I think that there are many ways in which the school becomes a kind of home for many of us. And our classmates serve in much the role that brothers and sisters serve in families.
You're listening to Tidings from Hazel Khan on WPKN 89.5 Bridgeport and streaming live on WPKN.org. We're talking about what home means to global nomads and to people who grew up as third culture kids.
Class reunions, then. I mean, I don't know anything about other school reunions because I haven't been to them, but do you think that there is a special quality to these class reunions? Or does everybody think that about their class reunions, wherever they come from?
Maybe they do, but I think there's something very unique about it. And the fact that people will go to such troubles, expense, travel all over the country, do really extraordinary things to get to these reunions. And it's always to the amazement of their spouses or whatever.
Because they might involve coming from other countries.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. By definition.
And it's very important. And it doesn't seem to matter how very much, how long you were there or
at the school.
And I think it's because this is a collection of people who sort of understand your rootlessness.
And they're kindred spirits in a very significant way. Mm-hmm. So then what do you consider home now? I mean, has that changed with time?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I don't really know what I consider home at this point. I mean, I have an address, I have, you know, the place my children grew up, the place where I can find my husband, and, you know, this is the normal definition of home. But I think I don't endow that with the kind of awe that my parents exhibited when they talked about home. There's nothing that I've experienced that makes me want to give up the sense of freedom and movement and new experiences. I don't want to give up elsewhere.
What would happen if you did? I mean, what would you be missing? What would you be losing?
Hope? I'd have to really accept everything about where I was. When you have a more loose sense of what is home, then you can take what you like and leave what you don't like and just, you know, live with it sort of thing. If you were really to commit to a place, a situation as home, then you would have to accept it totally. And I don't think I can do that.
It would have to also be the definition of you, then, that whole thing. You are defined by that home.
Yeah.
By home. And that just goes back to what I was saying about that there's a complete fit.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you are is that
place,
mm-hmm. that concept, that whatever it is. But as long as you don't completely accept it, then it's not all that you are.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Yeah.
People who know me, for example, I think sometimes they may unconsciously not count on me for things because it's often people say, well, where are you off to next?
Mm-hmm.
It's just the assumption is I will be off somewhere next. So mm-hmm. I'm not really reliable.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really count on me for
mm-hmm.
either whether it's a commitment to some cause or, I don't know, whatever, mm-hmm. can't really be counted on.
I think that, you know, I often chide myself about all of this because I think there is an element of irresponsibility in this sense of not being committed to a particular place and time, because you can't be depended on, mm-hmm. so people don't depend on you, and then you're free. And I'm not sure that's altogether good.
Oh, I think it's good. I think it's very good. I need to know that there's another else, not only that it exists elsewhere, but that I have somehow a plan to get on the road again. Mm-hmm. I need to know that there's something in the next month, 6 months, mm-hmm. sometime there's another thing, mm-hmm. because otherwise I start to get agitated. Mm-hmm. If there's no next place that I'm going to go to, otherwise I would feel that I'm not quite myself, or I would feel, not captive, that's not the wrong word, but something just would be out of balance, I think. Something like that. I find also that when I do come back from wherever it is, people will say, so, how was it? It's like, that is the wrong question. I don't have an answer for, so, how was it? Great! Mm-hmm. Yeah, did you have fun? Yeah, I had fun. I mean, but that is so not what it was about, you know. I don't know. So that's all part of the distance and the not fitting in. I mean, it's not a serious thing, not fitting in. I mean, I'm not an outcast. I'm not a, what's the word, a deviant or anything like that. It's just...
Or a pariah.
No, it's just different. You know, mm-hmm. There's this thing that will just endure. And in my particular situation, I didn't have... My parents were not of another country. Mm-hmm. Your parents were American, and they mm-hmm. had... Their home was... My parents did not have a home because mm-hmm. they were refugees. So I don't know, maybe Palestinians feel this way too when they're, you know, in other countries. I don't know. No, actually, that's not true, because they would have a very strong sense of home because it's tied to the land that mm-hmm. they came from. So in a sense, I'm not exactly a third culture kid because I didn't really have a passport culture, which mm-hmm. is how I think it's defined by the passport culture, and there's the host culture, mm-hmm. and then there's the third culture.
Yeah.
So I didn't really have a passport culture because for me, I've expressed it sometimes as my accent is always wrong. Wherever I go, people say, where are you from? But when they hear me. So it's not...
There's no place where you sound normal.
Where I sound as if I'm from there, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would hate people to think that this, as I said, that this is a handicap or that, you know, it's an affliction. Because mm-hmm.
It's a richness. Really.
I think it's a richness. I mean, I can't imagine being without it. But your children, for instance, the next generation, would you say that they have... They're
very clear on where home is. And it's kind of scary to me because it's... I don't feel that that's home in the way that they feel mm-hmm. that it's home. And as we think about selling our house, the kids are pretty emotional about it. And I'm just... Not at all. And I think, you know, this is strange.
There's just always this other thing that's going on. That's part of, you know, if one had to draw a painting of oneself, paint a painting, there'd be some either undefined or oddly colored part or something of the portrait, which is this third culture thing or this whatever it is, it's just another dimension that is an integral part, but not integrated to the outside world. Something like that. No, I am very glad that I've had this multicultural sort of life of dissonance. There's a lot of dissonance. But for you, I meant to ask you too, for you it was particularly painful. Yeah, you can talk about this in a way that I couldn't. When you did come back to America mm-hmm. for furlough, and especially your last year of high school,
yes.
You talk about that. I mean, because you went to school and you went through your entire schooling.
Yeah, I was at the boarding school from kindergarten through, and then my parents' furlough fell due when I was going to be a senior in high school. So I came to the States with them.
How did they prepare you for that? Or didn't
they? Oh, it's sort of, we'd always known it was going to be that way. And so there I was in Hartford, Connecticut, going to Hartford Public High School, just off the boat, literally. And
Hartford, why?
My father was working on his doctorate.
Oh, I see.
There, mm-hmm. Right. At the Institute on World Religions.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went to the public school, several phenomenon. One was I had no idea how to deal with crowds of people, and I would walk down the wrong side of the hall and get, you know, probably run over by some class that had just gone. I mean, there are traffic patterns.
Oh, because in India they drove on the...
Well, no, I mean, it was just that I didn't know that was important as to where you walked in a hallway. So
you're literally going against the flow, sort of thing.
Yeah, it's sort of up the down staircase kind of mm-hmm. thing. And then in class, the teacher would ask a question, and I always answered questions the teacher said. You know, I'd raise my hand, and this is not as common in public school classrooms as it was in my experience. So anyway, the teacher would call on me, and I would answer. And then there would be giggles all around the room because I had quite a British accent.
Mm.
And that was mortifying to me.
Sort of an Indian accent,
yeah.
Probably Indian, Anglo-Indians kind of accent.
Yeah.
Yeah. But not American.
So I would try to lose that. And I was gratified one time when a new girl came. And she, as we got acquainted, she says, "Are you from Canada?" I figured I was getting closer anyway. But
and what about things like clothes and pop culture and all those things?
Well, see, I didn't understand any of that hardly. I had a couple of friends who kind of took me under their wing and helped me through some of that. But I muddled through. I didn't know how to use the telephone. I didn't know how to ride buses, any of those
things. Really? Did you? What about the whole boy-girl thing? Because, I mean, what, you were 17 or something like that?
Yeah, I was 17. And I just didn't get into that year. There was too much going on in my life to even think about that.
It's no wonder Midge didn't feel at home. So you've heard my friends and me, third cultural kids once, global nomads thereafter, and always restless. Never quite at home, no matter what we call home at the moment. You've been listening to Tidings from Hazel Khan, heard on the second Wednesday of every month on WPKN, 89.5 Bridgeport, and streaming live on WPKN.org. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.